Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, the effort to turn canal banks into trails recently took a big step forward in Fresno. We'll talk to one of the founders of the local trail system and find out why some older Fresno neighborhoods may soon be getting some new amenities in the form of trails. We'll also be joined by one of the co-authors of a new study at Stanford that looks at the links between climate change and California's drought. The news isn't good, but we'll find out what it means for Central California as temperatures warm up and the snowpack gets smaller and smaller. That and a look at Valley poetry post-Philip Levine. The Pulitzer Prize winner and U.S. Poet Laureate died last month, but his legacy lives on in a number of Valley poets, including David Campos, who will join us today to talk about his new book, Furious Dusk. But first, we turn our attention to the world of food. Imagine eating at your favorite restaurant and being told that the salad on your plate was harvested from the cracks in the sidewalk. Would you eat it? Two professors from UC Berkeley think you should. Their project is called Berkeley Open Source Food. To get these greens from the ground to your dinner plate, they're commissioning high-end restaurants like Berkeley's Chez Panisse to use them and show the public that what we think of as weeds are not only safe to eat, but have lots of nutritional value. Since last spring, the professors and their students are trying to persuade people that healthy food is right under your nose, or in this case, between your heel and the pavement. From KALW in San Francisco, Olivia Cueva brings us this report.
I'm standing on a corner in West Oakland, and next to me are two men crouching near the ground. They're staring at what looks like cracks in the sidewalk.
That is really good mallow.
That's Tom Carlson, a physician and ethnobotanist at UC Berkeley. He's here with urban food forager and statistics professor Philip Stark.
This is incredibly lush. We're seeing cats here that are bigger than basketballs.
And they're talking about the edible and nutritional weeds that are growing wild in this neighborhood.
I mean, look at these. Extraordinary.
Oh! It's everywhere.
We've got some dock down here, too. Yes.
Rumex Crispus. This is very lemony.
Delicious.
They're snacking away, but this area isn't known for its access to fresh veggies. In fact,
we are technically in what the U.S. Department of Agriculture would call a food desert, in that it is low income, according to the Census Bureau, and more than a mile from a place you can buy fresh produce.
And that's what brings these professors here. With a grant from the Berkeley Food Institute, they're researching the edible vegetation that grows in food deserts, places that don't have access to healthy, fresh, and affordable food. They have three research sites, one in Richmond, Berkeley, and here in West Oakland, an area that doesn't even have a full-size grocery store.
Yet you look around along the sidewalks, in people's yards, in the medians, and you see lots of available food. And that's what we're out here understanding and enjoying.
When the professors find a patch of weeds, they estimate the serving size, take a photo, and record this info onto an app called iNaturalist, where the public can access the information. They also test the soil for heavy metals and the plant tissue for environmental toxins. So far, they have identified nearly 90 different species of edible weeds. Things like
plantago, English plantain, wild mustard, cat's ear, dandelion, mallow, sow thistle, bristly ox tongue, chickweed. I just love chickweed.
Many of these plants aren't native to the area. They were actually brought here by European explorers back in the 1600s because of their nutritional and medicinal qualities.
They keep coming back without being planted, without being watered. And so if you can't beat them, why not join them?
A little further down the street, we approach a white Victorian house with a picket fence and a perfectly trimmed lawn. It stands out from all the other yards because there are no weeds in sight.
And they probably put herbicides. There's no food, but it's all one species of grass, very nicely cut.
This is what has happened. Now when I go to a nice neighborhood where people have manicured lawns, they look like deserts to me because there's no food growing.
When Carlson and Stark see neighborhoods like this one, which has been neglected by city government, they don't pay much attention to the barbed wire and graffiti on the buildings.
Corrugated siding, paint peeling off the building.
They look at the weeds as high as your chest and see a Garden of Eden.
You don't really like this. Do you want to try it?
All right, I'll try it.
Go for it. It's very nice. It's in the buckwheat family.
It's like sourgrass.
It has the same thing makes it sour, oxalic acid.
I remember when I was a kid, the rumor was that sourgrass was sour because dogs peed on it. I asked them if they worry about dog pee or other contaminants.
Well, it just rained pretty hard, didn't it?
It's true. It did rain a lot this morning.
But wash them, okay? I mean, you're going to eat vegetables that could have cow manure on them, right? And you take them home and you wash them when you buy them at the store, right? And so, likewise, you collect these, you can just wash them.
The professors want people to recognize these weeds as food, even though they're not in a package. And it even goes further.
So what's the overall purpose of the project?
To let these communities know of the availability of free foods that can enhance their nutritional status.
Take care. Bye.
After we say goodbye, I stay around to see if anyone from the neighborhood will actually try these edible weeds.
How you doing?
I'm good. How are you today?
How you doing?
Ike Forrest lives in a house that has a bunch of mallow growing outside. When I tell him about the UC Berkeley project...
Did you know that these weeds are edible? Did you know that?
No, I don't think they're edible.
They are.
Well, if UC would pass through, you wouldn't say so.
But I tell Forrest what the professors told me, that he could just wash them.
So if it was proven that these were edible and clean, would you think about just cutting some down and eating them for salad or something?
Well, I got a son as a chef, and I'm going to ask him about that. Yeah. But no, I ain't going to eat that. No.
And Ike isn't the only one from the neighborhood that feels this way. Even folks who specialize in permaculture are skeptical.
Here we have like a yarrow root. Yarrow root is excellent, especially in the hood, because it heals cuts.
Brandy Mack is showing me around her garden.
My name is Brandy Mack. I'm a permaculturalist, health educator, and earth activator.
And a few years ago, Mac led her own edible tours in the neighborhood called Herbs in the Hood to teach black youth about urban foraging and plant resiliency. She hadn't heard about the professor's edible weeds project until I told her about it.
You know, would you eat the weeds growing from the ground? Let me start with that question.
So because I'm well-trained in it, certain weeds I would eat. Would my community, my children, my neighbors that I've known for years? No. Why? Because there's probably some kind of needle in there.
It's not just the garbage that makes it unappealing to eat from the ground.
Glass, Pampers, dumping sites.
Mac thinks it goes much deeper than that.
My folks will not look in the ground for healthy food, though this is where our ancestors planted everything. For folks to go down into the ground is saying, I'm broke, I don't have, I'm less than.
And that's why Mac doesn't think the Edible Weeds Project will be successful in her neighborhood.
Are we saying this is an alternative for opening another food bank in the community? Is this an alternative for no grocery store in our community? What do we do with it?
Professor Stark and Carlson want to have tastings in the community, and they're involving local residents to help map the edible weeds. But when I walk around the neighborhood and recognize all of the dandelion greens growing in the street, will I reach down for a snack? Not quite yet. For Cross Currents, I'm Olivia Cueva.
That report comes to us from our friends at KALW Public Radio in San Francisco. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. One of the defining physical features of San Joaquin Valley cities are their irrigation canals. Some are just small ditches, while others are massive channels, but they all carry vital water to cities and farms throughout the region and have helped to make the valley bloom
and our modern economy possible. Their banks are also an unofficial recreation spot for many. But in Fresno, a number of people want to change that, making their meandering paths part of a new network of community trails. Here to tell us more about that effort and a new development that could make that process easier is Mark Kepler. He joins us today and was a member of the Measure C Steering Committee and has been instrumental in the effort to create new trails in the Central Valley. Mark, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
You have done this sort of project before, turning old rail lines into trails, what are now the Sugar Pine Trail, the Old Town Clovis Trail.
Right.
This is taking that to another level, and it's something that's been talked about for a long time.
Oh, it's been talked about for a long, long time. I've been here since 1987. They've been talking about it at least as long as that. But you're right. We did the Sugar Pine Trail in Fresno and the Clovis Old Town Trail, which is about a 13-mile project. Started that in 1997. We had it basically completed by 2000, so within 3 years. But since then, it's kind of stalled trails in the community. Very little work has been done. The next real opportunity are these canal banks because there aren't a lot of abandoned rail spurs left. So the canal banks are something we were looking at and have been looking at for a long time, but there have been two issues that have really stalled the effort. And so a few years ago when Mayor Swearingen in Fresno was thinking about her second term and what she'd like to accomplish, she approached me about this and said, you know, could you get this off the dime essentially? And the two issues we had to address are liability and maintenance. So we methodically went and attacked those two issues, and we think we've got both of them now solved about a little over a year later. So we're ready to go.
So let's take those piece by piece.
Sure.
Liability is certainly a concern. People who've grown up in the Valley always hear the stories about injuries and sometimes, unfortunately, even deaths, people playing in the canals. That has to be a concern for any local government or the irrigation district which operates those canals. What is the development there along those lines that could help ease this process?
Very significant. Actually, you know, I'm a lawyer. I'm a labor lawyer, not a riparian rights lawyer. and I'm also a trails advocate. So if I tell the cities of Clovis and Fresno and the FID, hey, you have no liability here. If you build trails, they're going to look at me and probably not entirely believe what I'm saying because I think I have a dog in the fight. So knowing that, I actually went to the legislature because I'm also head of the Maddie Institute of Public Affairs and know some politicians. I went to I'm going to have a bipartisan effort. So I went to Assemblymember Perea and Assemblymember Patterson and asked them to sponsor legislation that would essentially take Fresno FID and the city off the hook for any liability if we build trails along canals. Even knowing and having read the law that we really didn't even need that because actually trails have absolute immunity under state law. So we're pushing this thing forward. I did speak to counsel in the legislature and he agreed with me. And I said, well, that's all well and good, but no one's going to believe me. I need a higher authority. While I do pray a lot on this issue, I needed something in writing. And so we thought it was a good idea to go to the legislative council, which is the highest legal authority in the state, a legislature, to give us a definitive ruling on whether or not there is any liability that attaches to trails and canal banks. Long story short, we asked for an opinion letter. We got one signed by the legislative council. It says that there is absolute immunity for trails along canal banks if they are recreational trails. In other words, you've got a situation now where canal banks are de facto trails. You have liability because they have not been designated as recreational trails. So we're actually providing an opportunity to take FID, the irrigation district, and the city off the hook in terms of liability. So it's exactly the opposite of what the argument that's been made. The argument that's made in the past is, oh, we're going to have liability if we put trails on canal banks. It's exactly the exact opposite. You lose liability if you put trails on canal banks. So they had it completely backwards. So we got that approved by the highest authority, so we took care of that issue. To everyone's satisfaction, I shared that opinion letter with both FID and the cities. Everybody seems to agree that resolves that issue. Second big issue was maintenance. And I was on the Measure C Steering Committee and was very concerned that if we wrote a provision that wasn't really tight, that the cities would find it, that money, as a way to kind of maybe backfill parks or other things and just no trails would ever get built. So when I wrote the provision in Measure C, I made it very tight and I said, listen, this is just for construction of new trails. You can't, you know, this isn't your piggy bank. Well, long story short, a few years later, the cities say, well, Mark, we can't build any trails because we don't have any maintenance money. But they said, you know, we could find outside money, federal, state, other money, to build trails, but we need money to maintain them. So being the negotiator that I am, I'm also a federal mediator, I said, let me think of a solution here. So the solution, I said, well, listen, why don't we do this? I will let you – we'll amend Measure C to allow you to use a portion of that money for ongoing maintenance, provided you go out and match that with some kind of outside non-Measure C money. And actually the deal we cut was a 5-to-1 deal. So if we give you $100,000 to maintain the trail, you've got to go out – you, the city, have got to go out and find $500,000 to build that trail. So I think that's a pretty good deal, a 5-to-1 deal for the citizens. And now we have money to maintain them. So the cities of Clovis and Fresno have agreed to that. They're the ones that are going to be building the trails and maintaining them. So we've solved the maintenance issue. So we've solved liability. We've solved maintenance. We've got a pilot project on the table right now, which would be on Shields Avenue. For those of you in the Fresno area, you might know that street. It's over by Route 41 going east of Shields along the canal bank there. It will eventually go down to McKinley and then out McKinley. And also the other way, it will go west down Shields over across Blackstone and then what's called Bankside Trail, head in a northwest direction.
There have been a number of people that have observed the excellent system of trails that have been built over the last two decades in this area and have noticed that the majority of them are in newer, more affluent parts of town, right, and that other older parts of Fresno have been left behind in that. Do you think this is something that can help address that? And what are the challenges in trying to bring equality there?
I live in the newer parts of town, and I specifically – and the reason why we built them there originally, not because I live there, is because that's where the abandoned rail spur was. But I totally agree with you. We have got to improve our urban core. We cannot have communities left behind. It cannot be a tale of two cities. They deserve the same amenities we have in North Fresno and Clovis. And so if you think about it, most of the canal banks are in the urban area. And I think that is an incredible opportunity to really improve the look, the quality of life for the residents in that area. And by the way, economically, it's going to be a benefit because research generally shows that if you build a trail, property values increase in the range of 4-6% within a half mile of that trail. So you're going to start seeing, you know, that is going to be a preferred place to live. People want access to that. And it provides additional park space. When we built the trail in Clovis, it increased – that one trail in Clovis increased park space in Clovis by 30%. And as you know, the city of Fresno has traditionally been last or next to last in terms of park space per thousand. It's now that has economic implications. I'm a business professor as well. We cannot attract businesses here or quality people here or get them to stay here unless we have the quality of life that they have come to expect. And if we can offer these amenities, it has a real economic benefit for the community.
Now, these are still working canals, unlike the rail lines you right. converted in the past, which were abandoned years before that. Are there extra challenges in dealing with this and that they still are conveying water? There's still that fast-moving cold water that is right there, and also the maintenance of the facilities, not just for the trail amenities but for the waterway itself. What are the challenges of doing this versus a rail project?
Great question, and two answers, I think. One is we understand that the primary mission of canals is to move water. Get that. So that's number one. That's preeminent. But there is a second point. The second point is we like to be efficient. You know, conservatives like to be efficient with the use of resources, with public assets. Right now, the only thing those canals are doing are moving water. Well, why can't they move people too? Why can't that be a quality of life amenity for the community? Why can't we get more out of that asset? The answer is we can. Now, there are some concerns when you have a trail along long canal. But guess what? They've done it in numerous communities around the country. Bakersfield has done it, for example. I just have a hard time believing that if they can do it in other communities, we can't do it here in the Central Valley. I think we can do it. We can probably do it better. And so I'm excited about the opportunity to really make this a signature amenity for Fresno. People say, you know, there's a potential here of 200 miles of trails in the urban area. Think about what that would do to the look and the perception of Fresno. If it had 200 miles of linear parks and trails, it's a different city. And I think in many positive ways. So yes, we can move water. Yes, we can do it carefully and responsibly. But yes, we can also do a better job of being more efficient and effective with the public assets that we have.
You mentioned the project on Shields. What's the next step and what sort of timeline are we looking at as this begins to roll out, Measure C money starts to be in play?
Right. I think right now, you know, I don't want to commit the city to anything. I'll get in trouble because I'll get calls from city staff. But right now we're thinking about we've had some discussions, probably doing the design work by this fall and have a shovel in the ground and, frankly, have it built by next spring. So it's going to happen pretty quickly. It's going to be about a half-mile segment, kind of as a demonstration. But I expect once we show that it can be done, which obviously it can, I think people are going to embrace it and they're going to want it in many of their communities. Just one final point on this, and that is, you know, it's amazing, you know, 15 years ago, whatever it was, longer than that, 18 years, it's been that long, 18 years ago, when we first started this project, I never expected it to be the Johnny Appleseed of trails. I thought I was going to do one project and walk away. And 18 years later,
that's what happens in the valley.
Yeah. I'm still doing it.
It pulls you in.
But the city council has, whether, you know, from the Democrat to Republican, liberal to conservative, they are all embracing this. You know, liberals will say, you know, it's for the environment. Conservatives are going to say it's economic development. It doesn't matter. Everyone gets it, that this is a positive for the community. So I'm very encouraged and very enthusiastic about what's happening in the community. I think, like I said, this could be our arch, like it is in St. Louis or the Golden Gate in San Francisco. This 200-mile network of trails in Fresno, Clovis could be stuff that people say, I want to live in that community.
And you've seen Clovis continue to improve their trail system. They just recently opened up a new entryway into one of the trails on
– a trailhead, yeah, on Shepherd Avenue. And that's for – it's designed for cyclists to go there. They can actually repair their bikes. They can do air pumps. We're actually – as a matter of fact, this morning I was talking to Clovis staff about putting air pumps along various locations along the Clovis Trail so people don't have to go hunt for a gas station and change in their pocket to put air in their bike. It'll be right there on the trail. They can just take care of it, you know, as they're biking.
We're talking with Mark Kepler here on Valley Edition today about the trail project in Fresno and some new news that eases the concerns of some about liability and other things in regards to financing the maintenance of trails throughout the city. Mark, you have another hat that you wear as well as executive director of the Kenneth L. Matty Institute at Fresno State. You also have a number of students involved in the program, mm-hmm. scholarships and fellowships in Sacramento, working with state legislators, internships. There's a new fellowship, though, that you have that I want to ask you about. What is this wonderful public service scholarship?
Alinda and Stuart Resnick of Paramount Farms approached us with developing a graduate fellowship of almost $60,000, two of them, to sponsor Valley students to go on to Harvard, Yale, you know, you name it, a top school, but then come back to the Valley and be really create the next generation of Valley leaders. So it's kind of a reverse brain drain. So the applications are open until March 20th. Think about this. If we were to have, you know, our very best and brightest go on and get, you know, education at the top schools in the country and then return to the Valley two a year, every year, in 10 years, we have 20 incredibly talented people as city managers, city planners, elected officials. I mean, it's incredible. That could be transformational for the region because it really does start with leadership. You've got to have good leadership, particularly in the Valley, where we have, as everyone knows, incredible challenges and very limited resources to deal with those challenges. So here, we just don't need good leadership. We need outstanding leadership because we've got to be really efficient and effective in dealing with those problems. So I'm very excited about that. I think that's, you know, something that we could – you know, everybody wants to have a career where they're going to make a little bit of a difference and leave the world a little better than they found it. I think that this thing that the Resnicks have done is really going to make the Valley a better place. And by the way, there are no strings attached here. I mean, they said, find great people. That's all we care about. And so that's what we're doing. And so we're excited about that.
So this is not limited to any particular political party or
absolutely
affiliation?
Absolutely not. We are nonpartisan. We want great people. You know, and whether you're Democrat or Republican, liberal or conservative, there are great people on both sides of the aisle who really care about the community. And my thought has always been on politics. Listen, it's Ken Manny's approach. Ken Manny's approach was – his reason for success was he always looked at the other side and said, I'm not going to assume the worst in that person. I'm going to assume the best in that person. I mean, they may approach something because they have a different life experience, but we're both aiming at point B. Point B being making the community a better place. And so, you know, we want to attract those kinds of people with that kind of passion to make the region a better place.
You have the deadline of March 20th. If people want information, what should they do?
Just contact the Matty Institute at Cal State Fresno or send me an email. which you can find on our website. I won't try to repeat it while people are in the car trying to write things down.
Just Google it.
That's right. Just Google it. Mark Kepler. Happy to provide information. It's not a very onerous application, and we really want to shake the tree hard here and see what falls out. We want the best possible people applying for this fellowship.
Again, Mark Kepler from the Kenneth L. Mattie Institute at Fresno State talking about the new wonderful public service fellowship that provides how much again?
It's $56,000 specifically.
For graduate education. Again, Mark has more information on that. And also talking about the Trails Project as your other avocation here today. Again, Mark Kepler, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment and learn about a new study from Stanford researchers about California's drought and climate change, what it means for the Valley, straight ahead on Valley Edition. Listening to Valley Edition, California is now in the fourth year of its ongoing drought, and the meager snowpack has water experts worried this year. But scientists at Stanford's Woods Institute for the Environment say that in just a few decades, this severe condition could be the new norm thanks to climate change. Their new study examining the link between drought and global warming was released last week. Co-author Daniel Swain joins us now on Valley Edition. Daniel, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel, your study takes a look at the links between hot temperatures and periods of drought in California. I want to talk about the future in a little bit, but what do we know from the historical record about the link between those two things?
Well, we know that in California's historical record that warm temperatures and cold temperatures and dry conditions and wet conditions were occurring with pretty much equal frequencies. It was almost a coin toss, in fact, over much of the 20th century, whether conditions were warm or dry or wet or cool. But what we've seen in the most recent couple of decades is a new trend towards increasingly warm conditions. And the net effect of that means that in years that are already dry, there's a much greater chance that those dry years are now also warm years.
Now, on the surface, it would seem that like there's a very logical connection there, dry years, warm, dry conditions, lack of rain. This also poses an additional problem that maybe is less immediately evident to most people, in that those warm conditions mean the snowpack melts that much quicker.
That's right. Yeah, these warm temperatures that we've observed, not just this year, but in recent winters, has had a really profound impact on the amount of snow, especially in the Sierra Nevada mountains. And in this winter in particular, when we've recently experienced the warmest winter in California's history, in fact, as of the end of February, snowpack in the Sierra Nevada has either reached or even perhaps slightly exceeded the all-time record lows for this time of year. And so the extremely warm temperatures, both in the preceding several winters and up to the present, have certainly played a role in creating that extremely low snowpack condition this year.
Now, let's go ahead and look ahead, because that's really what your study does. And you look ahead the next 25 years to the year 2040. What do you and your study authors say will happen after looking at the data that you've plugged into your system?
Well, what we see is that in climate models where we include the human emission of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, that we not only reproduce the observed warming trend in California, but we also find that warming trend persists and, in fact, increases as we move forward. And while the risk of years that are already dry being extremely warm has already increased due to global warming, in the future, and in the not-too-distant future, in fact, just a few decades looking forward, we reach a condition where pretty much every year that has low precipitation also has warm to hot temperatures, meaning that all droughts in the future will effectively be hot droughts in California.
What type of data do you use to model something like that?
Well, the primary tool we use when we're looking forward into the future are our climate models, which are these mathematical models that take into account various principles of physics and chemistry. And they're in many ways very similar to the same mathematical models that are used to forecast the weather day to day. We just make slightly different assumptions and use them as tools in a slightly different way. But they're fundamentally similar techniques.
And what are the implications that your study has for policymakers and others reading this study?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's particularly interesting in light of the fact that the current event in California is a very warm drought, and we're seeing, you know, the effects of a drought that is occurring with record warmth coincident with it, and that, as you mentioned, has a lot to do with why the snowpack is so low. And so I think, in a certain sense, the drought right now is illustrative of the kinds of impacts we would see in the future when conditions are persistently warm and then also sometimes dry. So, you know, we will see future droughts. California has seen droughts in the past, of course, but the kinds of impacts we see from future droughts are likely to be similar to the one during the present drought, given the similarity with these really warm temperatures to what we expect in the coming decades.
You mentioned looking back to the last 150 years. Did your study look back perhaps even further into the climate record? And I know that last year there were some stories out there that if you looked at the recent history of the West being settled, that we were in something of an atypically wet period, and that in prior centuries, going back hundreds and hundreds of years, things were drier then. Have you seen similar things in your analysis?
Right. Well, so our current analysis only goes back to the late 1800s. We don't go back all that far, certainly in a geological context, and we don't even go back, you know, to California's founding as a state. Obviously, that occurred before the late 1800s. But you know, what we're taking a look at is the risk of drought being influenced by changes that are occurring quite quickly from a climatic perspective, on the order of decades. Where changes of that magnitude usually take millennia to occur. And when we do look in the past, of course, California has been subject to great droughts on timescales anywhere from years to decades to even centuries in the very, very distant past. And we know that from over the last couple thousand years. We know that from tree ring records. We know that from various what we call proxy records, which are essentially ways we can tell what's going on in the atmosphere with respect to temperature and precipitation, going back well before when we actually had humans measuring temperature with thermometers or precipitation with rain gauges. And what we see when we do that is that, of course, there are large droughts in the past, but that the combination of warmth and dryness that we're already experiencing this year is something that we haven't really seen in the past millennium, and that's not our finding in this study. That's a finding from another recent study that's been published within the past year, and that was ascertained by looking at tree rings from California, oak trees, in fact. And so while we don't look back that far with our methodology, because, of course, we didn't have thermometers or precipitation gauges going back that far, you know, there is that probably helps place the current event, at least, in some broader context, going back more than just 100 years.
We've been talking with Daniel Swain. He is the co-author of a new study from Stanford's Woods Institute for the Environment that looks at the link between climate change and California's drought, and predicts that by 2040, the state will experience all of its droughts in hot and warm conditions, making the water situation even more precarious in the Golden State. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you again.
You're listening to Valley Edition. We want to take a brief break from the news now to bring you some news of our own. If you're a frequent listener to Valley Public Radio, you may have noticed a new voice on our airwaves over the past few days, that of Jeffrey Hess, who is our new local government reporter here at FM 89. He joins us now on Valley Edition. Jeffrey, welcome.
Thank you.
Hey, Jeffrey, it's great to have you here. Welcome to the Valley Edition team. First of all, you may be new to us here in the San Joaquin Valley, but you're not a stranger to public radio. Tell us a little bit about your background in public media.
Yeah, I have almost 10 years of radio experience in general, but I've been in public media now only for about just a little under 5 years. I got my start in public radio in Jackson, Mississippi for Mississippi Public Broadcasting. It's a statewide radio network. They have 8 towers, so all the programming is the same, much like with Fresno and Bakersfield channels that we have here. But that's where I really got my big start. I was their capital reporter as well as their healthcare reporter. So I spent a lot of time in the state capitol there covering government and politics. So I'm very familiar with that side of the reporting and how difficult it can be to make government stories interesting and entertaining to listen to. And also, I've got a lot of background and experience with covering healthcare stories, which, as everyone knows, with healthcare reform coming online and health being one of the most essential things of everyone's life. Everyone is at some point going to go to a doctor. Hopefully, you would go to your doctor. But so I have a lot of that experience as well with in public media, specifically in radio. I also have a little bit of television experience as well.
Well, we're looking forward to hearing some of that on the air. And you mentioned government. You'll be reporting on local government for us here in the Valley, not only Fresno City Hall and the County Board of Supervisors, but also some of the congressional candidates and congressional office holders, those who represent us in Sacramento as well.
Yeah, I was just getting my contacts lined up with the congressmen who represent the area earlier today. They were all very welcoming. Well, their staff is very welcoming. But it's definitely going to be a big shift for me going from thinking about a statewide impact to thinking about valley-wide impact. So I've got in my mind the capability to find stories that affect a wide swath of the listening audience without being too hyper-local and specific while still providing good information that everyone in our listening audience can use.
Well, we definitely are looking forward to having your reports on Valley Edition and on all of our programs here on Valley Public Radio. You'll hear Jeffrey's feature reports throughout our broadcast day, but you'll also hear Jeffrey on In the Mornings with Marv Allen as a new newscast voice bringing you local news in the mornings.
Yeah, I have some anchoring experience. I anchored our Mississippi Edition or the Morning Edition on MPB. So I'm very familiar with that, with doing the news in the morning. I am not very familiar with waking up at 3:30 in the morning to come on and be on air at 5 and to make sure everyone gets the freshest news on your drive into work, or for some people, your drive home from work if you work the third shift. But I'm looking forward to it. It's something that I really love. You know, I've dedicated my life to it. I have a college degree in communications, so I set out to do this. This isn't something I stumbled into. This is very intentional. I really enjoy public media. I love the people who listen to it and the people who feed us story ideas and the people I get to interact with. So it's a very exciting opportunity for me.
Great. Well, again, all of our listeners are equally excited to hear your voice on the radio and hear your reports on in the coming weeks and months here on Valley Public Radio. Again, we're talking with Jeffrey Hess, the newest addition to the FM 89 news team, and you'll hear him on Morning Edition as well as this program in the future. Jeffrey, thank you so much for taking the time, and now back to the beat.
Yeah, thank you. I'll get back to work, boss.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Here's a thought for you. Do bad ideas and evil ideology spread like a disease? In this edition of FM 89's commentary series, The Moral Is, Fresno State philosophy professor Andrew Fiala argues that rotten ideas and pernicious ideologies will die out, and good ideas will eventually succeed, so long as we engage in moral and mental hygiene.
We tend to fear that immoral behavior is contagious. Some fear that terrorism and radical ideology spread like a disease. But is this really true? Are evil ideas really contagious? Some idiots do commit copycat crimes, and an old saying holds that one rotten apple spoils the bunch. But human beings are not fruit. The vast majority of us are reasonable beings, not seduced by the pernicious ideologies of the rotten apples. Our bodies have natural resistance to disease, and our souls have a natural resistance to vice and to bad ideas. Good nutrition and proper hygiene help to prevent the spread of disease. Morality and reason work in much the same way. The roots of our ideological immune system are tightly woven into our social and psychological DNA. Most of the time, most people are decent, kind, and reasonable. Moral vaccines and rational booster shots also help. Education, philosophy, and science can provide us with extra resistance to ideological corruption. A daily regimen of moral and mental hygiene is essential for ethical fitness. Take time to be mindful, build nurturing relationships, avoid corrupting influences, cynical associates, violent media, racist ideology, sexist imagery, and the like. And above all, seek the truth. Some worry that this is not enough, perhaps thinking that evil is so insidious and powerful that it cannot be resisted. But to think this way is to already admit defeat. Good ideas, if they are really good, are obvious, reasonable, and desirable. There is no guarantee, of course, that good ideas triumph every time. But in the long run, unlike apples in a barrel, human beings have the capacity to understand the good, choose the reasonable, and resist corrupt ideologies. Some worry that any new idea is evil. Conservative defenders of tradition view new ideas as dangerous contagions to be resisted and eliminated. But dumb and dangerous ideologies can't overwhelm good sense. Ideas are not viruses that infect us against our will. Rather, good ideas catch on because we understand their value, and bad ideas die when they are exposed as evil and untrue. The difficulty is, however, that when it comes to ideas, there is more than one kind. Even apples come in various colors. There are also pears, peaches, and persimmons. Some of our fear of ideological corruption is actually a fear of variety. We don't want our apples contaminated by the apricots and avocados. Some fruit is really rotten and ought to be thrown out. Any ideology that calls for murder and mayhem should be rejected, but in throwing out the bad, we should not discard the merely different. One important component of physical, moral, and mental fitness is a balanced diet. Good fruit comes in many flavors, and one rotten apple rarely spoils the whole barrel. For The Moral Is, this is Andrew Fiala.
The commentary series The Moral is a production of Valley Public Radio and the Bonner Center for Character Education at Fresno State. The views expressed are those of the author and not necessarily those of the station or the center. You can find more commentaries on our website at kvpr.org. You're listening to Valley Edition. Last month, the nation and the San Joaquin Valley lost an icon in the world of poetry, Pulitzer Prize winner and U.S. Poet Laureate Philip Levine, who passed away at his home in Fresno. One of his lasting legacies wasn't just his work, though. It's in the poetry community that he helped to foster here in Central California, which has since become known worldwide. Names like Gary Soto, David St. John, Larry Levis, and our next guest, an emerging poet, David Campos. His new collection of poems just won the prestigious 2014 Andres Montoya Poetry Prize, which is dedicated to supporting the work of emerging Latino poets. The book is called Furious Dusk and was published by the University of Notre Dame Press. David Campos joins us today. He's also an English teacher at Fresno City College. David, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Before we start, I just want to ask you to comment on the legacy of Philip Levine. And you're one in a line of many Fresno poets who in some way owe something to the poetry community that he helped to create here. What are your thoughts when you think back at him and the community of poets that we have here in the Central Valley?
I think without him, poetry in Fresno wouldn't really exist the way I have come to know it. Even Andres Montoya himself was a student of his, and the first time I saw Philip Levine read was at a memorial reading for Andres Montoya. And that's the first time I saw him read, and I became aware of his influence here in Fresno City and in the Fresno poets community.
Now, talking about poetry is an interesting thing because we delay the actual reading of the poetry, which we will do in a moment before the end of the program. But I want to talk about this new collection, Furious Dusk. One of the judges of the competition wrote the following, and they said, a work whose five parts trace the son's efforts only partially successful to fulfill his father's expectations and perhaps even more difficult understand those expectations enough to forgive them. Your work is very personal. It's drawing on your personal experience. Was this a challenging project?
Very challenging emotionally, personally. Even some of the poems, I'm getting in trouble with family members, and because of how personal and how honest sometimes I can be with these poems. But I felt like the honesty needed to happen. The honesty needed to be inside the poems in order for the audience to really know what the poem was trying to get at.
How do you deal with that as a writer, as a poet? Is there that sometimes that feeling to almost self-censor?
Yes. There's always that moment of like, I don't want to send this out. I don't want to send this out, but it needs to be out there. Other people have gone through similar experiences. They need to know that they're not alone.
The death of your father was definitely a big part in this collection and shaping where you are today. How did you deal with that on the page?
Now, that was not true.
Well, it's not.
No, it's not true. I had to I guess, metaphorically kill him, or the father that I knew as I became aware of who he was as a human being. Ah. So before I held him up on this pedestal and finally seeing who he was and interrogating what he had done and how he taught me to be a man and how wrong that was over a period of time, that bringing him down and just putting that to rest and letting me see who he was as a human being allowed me to grieve for who I thought he was before. So that's one of the misconceptions, I guess, that people think of when they read this.
That's a powerful idea.
Mm-hmm.
Very much so. Again, we're talking with poet David Campos. His new collection of poems is called Furious Dusk. It just won the prestigious Andres Montoya Poetry Prize. What was it like to receive that honor and someone that was very influential in your life? It's named for him.
Yeah. His book, The Ice Worker Sings and Other Poems, was the first poetry collection I ever read. So beyond that, I came back, and when I received that call, it was mind-blowing. It was world-shifting. I had never really anticipated it before. Like, I'm going to be an author. That blew my mind, and it still blows my mind. I'm still getting emails every now and then that says, I love your book, and I'm just like, oh, my God, this is happening. This is really happening.
How did you wind up in this profession? How did you go from growing up to becoming a poet?
I had a brilliant English teacher in high school at Fresno High before she moved on to teaching at Clovis East. Her name was McKendra McCoy, and I don't know if she was lying to me, but but she said, you have a talent, you know, with writing. And that's when I really started pursuing English as a career. I wanted to be just like her. I wanted to teach. So I pursued a teaching degree.
And now you are teaching at Fresno City College, working with young people. Do you see a little of yourself in those faces staring back at you?
All the time. And I love it. I love the interaction with the students. It just reminds me of myself so much. And I constantly remind them, you know, it's possible to succeed.
And it has to be great to see someone like Gary Soto, who's had so much success and now comes back to City College. Maybe talk about that. What is that like for them to not only see, hey, my professor just won this award and he has a book, and then Gary Soto is coming back to City College and he does all the things there. It has to be inspiring for them.
It is. I've even mentioned, because he gives personal tours of the museum there, and I mentioned to my students, go on one of these tours, talk to him, visit the museum, see what is available out there, not only for yourself, but, you know, for maybe your friends who may be interested in writing, right, and in this career.
Let's go ahead now and hear something from this new collection. Again, it's called Furious Dusk by poet David Campos, who joins us on Valley Edition today. Tell us first about what we're going to hear, and then maybe read a poem for us.
Now, this is actually true. One of the things that I talk about is infertility and the inability to have a child. So I'll just jump right into it. The title is Prayer. Reading polycystic ovary syndrome from lab results, the ink permanent. My wife's eyes lose their blue, trying to understand the dyslexia of her body. The confused twitch of her brows shake the language I speak from my tongue. Did you see us burn the copy we took home? The blackened shreds floating like moths. I pray, leave us alone. Let us walk to the bus stop without the shrill of all the children we can't have playing at the daycare on the corner. The laughter.
Again, a poem by author David Campos. His new collection of poetry is titled Furious Dusk. It just received the 2014 Andres Montoya Poetry Prize from the University of Notre Dame and their Latino Studies program. How did you manage to What was the process like? Do you enter this competition? Is there a call for entries? Does
yeah,
somebody
a call
contact
for,
you and say, hey, we want you to enter? Or?
Yeah, there's a call for entry. And the contest is only once every 2 years. So the last time I entered, I was a finalist. And I didn't Lorianne Guerrero won. And I was persistent. I was resilient. I was like, I'm going to fix this manuscript. So I went to grad school. And in grad school, when I got my MFA, I completely rewrote the manuscript. And when it was done, I sent it out again. And then it won.
And now it's your first book.
Now it's my first book.
That has to be incredibly satisfying to see your name in print. Now, people can also see you in person and get a copy of this book. Tell us about the event that's coming up at Arte Americas.
The book launch event is at Arte Americas in downtown Fresno, and it is March 21st. It is a Saturday from 4 to 7 p.m.
Again, poet David Campos, his new book is called Furious Dusk. He is the winner of the 2014 Andres Montoya Poetry Prize. He is also an English teacher at Fresno City College. And I'm sure his students are equally excited to see their professor go on to such great heights. David, thank you so much for joining us today, and congratulations.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us talk@kvpr.org or follow us on Twitter. We are at KVPR and at Valley Edition. So send us a tweet and we'll follow you back. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporter Deanna Aguilera and Jeffrey Hess, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.